discussing for this third session. We're going to pick up from the things we talked about regarding the diaconate and think about the congregation. How about just to keep this before us, we recite our verse again. Verse reference. Titus 3:14. Our people must also learn to engage in good deeds to meet pressing needs so that they will not be unfruitful. Titus 3:14. There we go. So developing a congregational approach to mercy. Well, I want to come back to the diaconate for a little bit here and then move into what does a church do when, you know, someone shows up at your door, so to speak. What are some ideas about that? And some of these slides, I've got some of the documents that I used when I was a pastor in Kokomo, Indiana. And you're not going to be able to read all of it, but I'm just putting it into the slides because you'll have it later. But I'll explain some of the features of them as well. So these are, if you take a class on, you know, PowerPoint presentations, this would fail. So I'm not trying to, I'm just trying to give you information ideas is the idea here. I was in a church planting situation where for a time we didn't have deacons. We didn't start with deacons. You know, different people will think differently about that, but we were small enough. I felt like the elders, we could take care of most of the issues and you know, handle it in formal ways. But then as time developed, we really needed diaconal help, and so we had deacons. And then as we kept, you know, deacons cycle in, cycle out, we, you know, just had a class on the diaconate for one time where we really felt like we needed deacons. Sometimes you can readily see the men that you want in a congregation or the people you want in a congregation to be deacons. Other times, you know, it's not quite so clear, and sometimes a class can help. I think everyone should have familiarity with the office of diaconate, so we invited anyone who wanted to come to this, but particularly if you were interested in being a deacon. And so we talked about deacon in office, which was some of what I just gave you in the last section. Just, you know, helping people understand. Sorry, we're still learning this over at College Hill. We've had some interesting elections over there the last few years that we'll go and we'll want, you know, we need like four deacons and we get one, and there's just a mess. We're learning how to process better. There's a whole process to this, and the need for shepherding people through elections and helping them to understand this isn't a popularity contest, or, you know, if the elders bring in nominations, maybe they've thought about this, and you might want to, you know, okay, you can make your nominations, but why populate the nominating ballot with 20 people and split all those votes? And or if you do that, why not ask if some of them want to withdraw when they got two votes and, you know, things, but a lot of that wasn't happening. So anyway, you have to help people work through the whole election thing. I think it's very much a shepherding event, and we need to help. And to understand ordination, too. People, in our day, our culture, people don't understand ordination. It's just this ritual to a lot of people that you do, and it's kind of nice to see all the elders come up and lay their hands on. Makes us feel nice and secure, maybe. But there's more to it than that. And what does it mean when we ordain people? And then how the deacons are to relate to the session. I had other men. Jason Camry was an associate pastor who had been a deacon, so it was very good for him to teach on in that third section. Oh, man, you can barely see that. The deacon's relationship to the session. I was just talking with Steve about how important that is to help. And the deacon and mercy, you'll notice here, I don't have the deacon and the budget and the deacon and the building. I very much believe that the diaconate, first and foremost, according to our church documents, is a office of mercy. It doesn't mean that it can't help take care of the building or help with the budget. But when the diaconate begins to head in that direction, then it's in trouble. In Geneva, you know, I think a lot of us romanticize Calvin sometimes, and we think, you know, he studied his Bible, and he saw in the Bible that there was a need for the office of deacon, and, you know, he got all his theological ducks in a row, and that's, he produced the office of deacon, voila, just out of the pure study of Scripture. Well, that's not what happened. At Geneva, people by the thousands were flooding in, poor immigrants fleeing persecution, many of them from France, his homeland, and they were overwhelmed. They did not know what to do with these people. And so they began, you know, through a series of activities trying to help them. And they went to their scriptures and they studied their scriptures, but it was really the heat of and the burden of caring for these people that they began to rediscover the office of the diaconate. And Calvin and the ministers created there the Bourse Francais, the French fund for the poor stranger. And they put men over that to administrate the finances. But it wasn't like just giving out money to people. It was a very developed system for training people, helping them to be able to produce income for their families. There was woodworking and sewing and all kinds of skills that were developed through the diaconate to help all these people. And so if Calvin was teaching on the diaconate, as I read one of those quotes earlier, it was because it was an office of mercy. And we've got to really recapture that, I think. I just see a lot of deacons are basically trying to do building management and finances and, yeah, sometimes mercy. And I think that's the wrong order. So we want to flip that a little bit on its head. So I taught things on mercy ministry there. We talked about some of our policies, which I'm going to share with you here. And also in our particular ministry setting, we had a relationship with the rescue mission, and those two men there, Ron Visser and Robert Jones, were deacons in our congregation, but also working full-time down at the rescue mission, which was a real blessing to us as a congregation. But we're going to talk a little bit later here about what about organizations outside the church? What should be our relationship to them? And then the deacon in the church just reminded them that they would be taking vows, so instructing them on the taking of the vows, how to delegate involving others. And then you'll notice down toward the bottom, there's the care for the building and finances of the church, because an RPCNA, that is a delegated responsibility, but it's not a sole responsibility, I don't believe. I think elders can get into trouble creating a dual authority in the church if they're not careful, if they're just putting all the building and all the finances over into the realm of the diaconate. It just can create a lot of tension and it's unnecessary. So I'm just training the church is important. Training the church in these things is so vital to helping create a healthy relationship between the elder and the diaconate, and then also them reflecting into the life of the congregation. We created policies for our deacons. Again, you can't probably read all that. That's okay. But you can read it when Matt sends it to you on email. And I don't know, maybe we should, I don't know if you already have that information, but maybe you could create a little email list and get people's email addresses. In our Constitution, the Directory for Church Government, it talks about the relationship between the session and the diaconates and the diaconate. And so we, you know, kind of based on that, set forth some guiding principles. The diaconate's a spiritual office, so it's important to remember that. It's not a crass office. It's not just mammon office. It's a spiritual office responsible for the ministry of mercy and stewardship of the congregation. Did I lose you? Sorry. It is neither a ruling nor a teaching office. Its exercise, like the whole church, is under the oversight of the session, and its function is administrative. I think that's a good sentence or two. The elders have the oversight of the congregation as well as the diaconate, and I think it's healthy when the deacons really see themselves as coming to serve the church, certainly, but also serve the elders. When they really see part of their job is to lift the hands of the elders so that they can do their job more faithfully, I think that's a right spirit that I see in the scriptures and I think is expressed here. So the way that we organized our deacons, I already know you have some of these things down, but this is just, you know, just by way of information. We did, you know, identify, as our constitution does, the three primary areas of ministry of mercy, stewardship of physical property, and treasury, and how that was going to work. We talked about, you know, are we going to have terms or not? We didn't put terms in. We just, it would have to be an action of the session to relieve a man of his office. And then in our way we did is, I think you guys said your deacons are with you monthly. Yeah, that's the way College Hill does it. We did it quarterly, but we encourage the deacons on those off months to be meeting monthly as well to be handling their work. And we gave them a responsibility to establish procedures, as it says there in the Ministry of Mercy. You know, God says to do good to all men in Galatians, but especially to those who are of the household of faith. And so how are we going to take care of our members and then our adherents and people in the community? The deacons will seek to cooperate with, receive counsel from, and provide counsel to the other biblical churches and agencies when deemed appropriate. We wanted, that's one of the things George Grant encourages, as well as I've seen in other works on mercy, is to realize you're not the only sheriff in town, so to speak, when it comes to mercy ministry. There's a lot of people already doing this work, and we can learn from them, and that's a good thing to do. And we can learn how to do mercy ministry from them, and we can also learn how not to do it from them. But we need to be educated. And I think we need to be asking our deacons, are they knowledgeable about what's going on in the community? What resources are available? How do things work out there? There's a system in place already. And the people on the streets know that system way better than the church usually does. And we got to get street smart. We've got to walk in their shoes and learn what they know. Now, again, I had the advantage of having men in our diaconate that in many ways, because of their job, knew these things. But that was so invaluable to our church. On one occasion, I mean, we were in the downtown area of Kokomo. And so we had people all the time stopping by asking. Sometimes I had to lock. I mean, I don't want you to get this idea that they're breaking down the doors or something. But it was so regularly that we would get people in that sometimes if I was there at the church, I just locked the door. I wouldn't get anything done because people keep coming into the building and asking for things. I've had to take drunks out of the building when we had an academy meeting there, and you know, Mr. York, there's some guy in the sanctuary and he's stumbling around, and you know, things like that. So that's just the kind of context that we were in. I remember one occasion; it was the Lord's Day. Usually, when people are in the building, that attracts people coming. A man came in and asked for help, and, you know, again, our people were trained to get an elder involved or a pastor, so I was brought to this man, and I said, well, you know, let's go. The deacons are actually up in my office right now. I think they're counting the offering or something. Let me go get them, and I'll have you talk with them. And Ron Visser comes out the door, and I'm not kidding, this guy sees Ron, and he turns around, and as fast as he can, he runs out the door. He just knew that, I mean, he told us right there he was, you know, just bumming, and here's somebody who would know how to call him out on it. So to be knowledgeable, the rescue mission had a database. So anybody who had come And they shared that with some of the other agencies in town. So anyone who had come to them asking for help, they had records of that. And that was very helpful. I kept, as I'm going to show you, I kept records as well of people who came to our church. And that was very helpful to be able to confirm, because there are people obviously out there that are working the system, and we don't want to be just helping them to continue on in that. And so holding them accountable is important. So our diaconate needs to be educated not only in the scriptures, but in the community and understanding the system that's already in place. It could be well-developed in Beaver Falls. I don't know. In Beaver County, I know of some things. I'm learning more about it. Or it could be very poorly developed, but there's still some system out there. And we do ourselves a greater service and make ourselves more useful to people if we're aware of it and how to interact with it. And anyway, just some of the things on the diaconate. Jonathan?
This is probably as good a time as any to ask. When you know the system, I'm particularly thinking of the governmental mm-hmm. system in place, what are your thoughts on when somebody comes to the church to say, well, we know you can get this help from a governmental agency, and directing them that way as opposed to we're going to take you under our wing? It's something I think about as far as ideally the government wouldn't do, some people might say would need to do,
yeah.
as much as mm-hmm. is set up and our taxes would involve.
Yeah.
Taxes to pay for it, right?
Yep.
But it is what it is currently. Like, you take a view that says we should try to take people under our wing so that they don't need to take anything from the government.
Mm-hmm.
Or you take the view of, well, it's there, it's in a lot of cases it's already paid for, it's not getting used or something.
Mm-hmm.
So get help everywhere you can.
Yeah. I'm going to say a little bit more about this in a moment, but just to maybe give you a thought is, I guess I took the weaning approach, is that, you know, people are, you know, suckling off the government, and it's creating a sense of dependency. And if I came in and just said, okay, cut it all off, if I'm not ready to help them somehow, then I need to be careful about that. I think, you know, there is a difference between morally wrong. I think there's some times where it's morally wrong to use certain agencies. Maybe they're lying or doing that, then you just say you can't do that, versus wise, versus learning how to take care of yourself rather than expecting someone else to do it, and how can I move them, you know, in that direction. So that's part of the answer. Let me, that's going to come up in a slide here in just a minute or two, a fuller answer to that. Yes.
My brother and sister-in-law were social workers. Well, the one, she'll be retiring. My brother's in China. They, like what you said, it was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
How they just take advantage and lie and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. And we go back to last night, the greatest need of the poor, what Jesus came to do, he said, was to preach the gospel to the poor. And they need to hear the gospel and be set free from their sins. And we see the immediacy of some of their difficulties. I mean, I had a lady in my office, and we're there with the deacons talking with her, and somehow her funding through the government agencies wasn't working. She was asking us for like $1,600 to fulfill some prescription that she said she needed for her health. Well, just in the immediacy of that, I mean, your heart goes out for her. You think, you know, what can we do? Do we take an offering? But we start asking a few questions, which is what I'm getting at here. And all of a sudden, you know, just to ask her questions, it started revealing some things about her lifestyle, started revealing some things about how she'd been spending her money. She got very angry and just walked out on us. I mean, we were trying to help her. And the deacons were being very compassionate in dealing with her. We felt sorry for her, but she wouldn't let us basically help her at that point in time. Because it does breed this kind of spirit of independency and unwillingness really to listen to the counsel that they need. So we've got to, the gospel has to stay at the heart of this, or else we're just going to end up being a dispensing agency, handing out a lot of money, and we're all patting ourselves on the back because we feel good we're doing mercy ministry, but we're really not ministering into the hearts and souls of people. Again, I'm not saying lots of resources, lots of things should happen, but we have to be careful how it takes place. And, oh, go ahead.
I'm just wondering, the slides, can you go back a slide?
Back to the previous one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we see, is that the entire document?
No, there's another, it's not a very long document. It was just 2 pages. Okay. And we had, I was, because this is mercy, I just had a few of the mercy lines. There was also the financial and the, oh, sure you can. Yep. I can send that. One of the things, a tool that became very helpful, is to train our church how to handle requests. Again, because of the uniqueness of our setting, we had an academy meeting at our church twice a week. There were teachers and ladies helping do administrative work in the church. And so I wasn't always the one getting these requests. Some of the ladies would answer the phone. We had a secretary answer the phone. What do you do? Especially if I'm in a meeting or, and, you know, and some of this I wanted deflected to others that could kind of help me out so I didn't get overwhelmed by it. So we created a request policy where if someone comes to us asking for help, we want to help them, but we need a methodology to do so. And so we wrote down the following information, and there's a form, I think, on this next page. You know, their name, their information, their needs. We'd ask them about their family. Are there other people that, a lot of these are on the phone or someone sitting in your office. What's your family like? Have you had work? Do you receive government assistance? Now, they can lie to any one of these questions, but eventually, if they're lying, it usually comes out. Why has this need arisen? Have you asked any family members for help? That's the first area of responsibility, biblically speaking. You know, have you really talked to them? A lot of them would say, yeah, but they're tired of me asking, or, you know, those kinds of things. And then, do you belong or attend a church? I can't believe how many people would come to us saying they wanted help, and then I would ask them about their church, and they say, well, I attend this Baptist church, or I attend this church in the area. And I said, well, have you asked them? Again, sometimes it would be, well, they don't want to help me anymore. Well, that's an indication to me. Well, why wouldn't a church be wanting to help this person? Or they just hadn't asked them. And so I would say, you know, we're here to cooperate with the churches. I don't want to, you know, you need to go. We'll go with you, or we'll call, or we'll talk, we'll help you. But your church needs to know that you have this need. Some people were ashamed to tell people in their own church. Well, that's not good. We need to help them in that. Have you approached any government agencies, the rescue mission, or other churches for help? And why did they deny you? And that tells you a lot there. Our mission would ask if people were living together and it was immoral. I mean, that's a perfect place to preach the gospel to them, and you're suffering some of the consequences of your immoral decisions. That doesn't mean you can't be compassionate. You might still end up helping them to some degree if they're willing to listen to the gospel. But if they start shutting down, or they start saying, well, don't judge me, or I don't want... Often we lost people just by asking them some questions that I think are very valid questions to be asking them. Jesus asked questions all the time. And so just asking him these things, and then why did you contact us? I say here on the sheet, not only does this help assess need, but it will often reveal those who are merely panhandling, and it even tends to chase away those wanting a quick buck. We had to teach our people not to feel badly if someone, I mean, you get a sweet woman in the church and some guy hangs up on her. I mean, she can be in tears afterward, and we have to kind of toughen them up a little bit and say, that's not you didn't do anything wrong. You were just presenting a faithful witness to them. So please don't cry. if in the process, questions reveal obvious sin, a live-in boyfriend, or, I mean, it's funny what people tell you. I use drugs, or, I think we have a moral obligation to tell them that you connect your bad behavior with your need here. But, some would say, yeah, I realize that. And if I hear even just a sign of brokenheartedness, I don't want to lose this. I want to keep working on them. So are you willing to receive information about God's word and the church? If they don't, we warn them. Their hunger or need could be God. I always say God's trying to get your attention. Why has he brought this into your life? He's wanting your attention. We tell them we won't be able to help them if they're not going to listen to the Lord. Remember in the Bible, Jesus fed the 5,000, sure, but it was after they'd sat there for a long time listening to the word of God. And so this is the need that people have. If they do agree to spiritual instruction, tell them you must talk to the deacons to see how you can best address their need. This is a big problem with pastors, is they get caught unprepared, and so pretty soon pastors are, I've been talking to a few lately, pastors are pulling their own wallets out and handing money to people, and don't do that. When I was an intern in Indianapolis years ago, I wanted to help people, and this guy came to the church, and I was just kind of there by myself. And before long, I'm driving this guy all over town trying to find someone who'll give him some money. And finally, he says, go to that church. And it's this huge mainline church. I go down, it had chandeliers and everything. We were walking down this, it was almost like a marbled hallway. He sees this guy coming in a well-dressed. And the guy in minutes opened his wallet up and handed him a 20 or something. And again, I learned. I've made lots. And don't think I'm a big expert up here. This is after years of making mistakes like this over and over and over again. And you do have to develop some experiential backbone in order to deal with people. So I tell people all the time, I'm not authorized to just help you myself. I have to. The deacons are authorized to do this work, and it just puts a check on me from getting overly involved, and it also reminds the deacons that this is their job and not necessarily mine. In my communication with the deacons, if there was a way that I could be involved and I don't mind helping, if it was a true grocery need, and I know Miriam's getting ready to go to the grocery store, she could buy the grocery. We want to be involved, but just not overwhelmed or taking over the responsibility for it. Again, we check the database, it says there, number 4, so that we were just making sure that we weren't duplicating, a sense of need. Usually it was a deacon or someone the deacon had arranged to go and to help them. And this kind of is getting at Jonathan's question, and it's coming up on a screen. We believed that the church is to be doing mercy ministry. And so we never just said, it would have been so easy just to say, go down to the rescue mission or go there. We never did that, because if they're coming to us, this could be an opportunity for us to do ministry. And I believe that's why God brought certain people to us through our time there. And then we always prayed for these people in our church gatherings, just an opportunity for prayer. We might not mention a name if we're wanting to respect confidentiality, but someone called the church this week and their daughter, prayed for that. So then we had this questionnaire developed that people trained could fill it out so that we had a record. And then we kept these on file. And on one occasion, I'm on the phone, and this person's telling me a story. And I'm starting to think, I've heard this story before. And it was really unusual the way, I think it was a lady, actually, was telling it. And so while I'm on the phone with her, I've got my file, and I start flipping through, and I pull it out. And all the lies were the same lies. And then so I brought it up, and there goes the click. You know, she didn't want to talk anymore. So anyway, it helps to be educated. So working with Christian agencies, we could also expand this to other agencies. But with respect to Christian agencies, remember they are an arm of the body, but they're not a replacement for the church. I think they're highly valuable. I mean, all the knowledge the rescue mission had, all the support from the community for their work there, I mean, that was a tremendous benefit to the church. So I don't want to come and say that that has no value. This is a way, really rightly understood, a mission or, you know, a agency like that can be seen as a, this is how we're expressing unity as the body of Christ across denominational lines. And we should, insofar as we're able, with our conscience. I mean, there are some agencies that claim to have a Christian ministry, but they don't. Across the street from our church, this Baptist pastor, lady Baptist pastor, started a ministry she called CAM, Coordinated Assistant Ministries. Some of the guys in our church gave it other names. SCAM was one of them. Coordinated Apostate Ministries was the other one. Because she just basically, the gospel didn't matter. It was just she was in competition with the rescue mission where the gospel was being upheld. And she was doing everything she could to connect that, you know, ministries. It was really government programs and fundraising and all of this to try to establish this mercy ministry across the street. And it was just unfaithful to the gospel. And so we had to kind of stand against it, even though it was right across the street. And we dealt with people all the time coming from there to our church. And just to give you an idea of how dangerous this can be, we have a church function out in our parking lot. It was a neighborhood. Sometimes we just have a neighborhood meal. Just we like to eat together, invite the neighborhood to come and eat with us. And this guy shows up, and I can't remember if he was one of these guys who had the Trail of Tears, you know, tattooed into his cheeks. But pretty soon, this whole story of him being a, you know, an worshiper of the Indian gods, but trying to act like he worshiped Jesus too, and all this started coming out. I found out he lived across the street. Well, I'm talking with him. He's getting, you know, I'm just trying to talk to him about the gospel. He's getting quite hostile with me, just sitting there, you know, over some food. And so I kind of back it away, and I go and talk to one of our deacons, and oh, you know who that guy is? He just got out of jail for rape. And we decided at the mission he should not stay here because of his record, and both before and inside prison. Well, we heard, I mean, it was just a couple of months later. I remember I was driving home listening to the news, and this man had raped someone else up in Fort Wayne, not in our community, but up in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And we've got to be careful. You know, there's a lot of dangerous people out there, and the wicked are out there, and we have to be really careful to make sure that our ministries are gospel-centered. So I think we work with government agencies, but we have to do some distinguishing about how deep the level of cooperation can be. As I say, work with the agency. Do not just send people to it. With respect to government things, I mean, a lot of these people who come are coming to you already. You know, they have jail records. Maybe they're on probation. They already have certain requirements to interact with government agencies. You know, that's God. You know, the government is God's arm of justice primarily. And so we can cooperate fully with that and encourage them to go and meet their appointments and all those types of things. If they're, you know, is something that could benefit them at a time and we're not able to meet that need and there is a government agency that's supplying that, I think there are legitimate functions for that. I think what we want to do just principially is to be drawing them more and more into the body of Christ, more and more into the household of God, more and more to a life of productivity. And we just, you know, as many people as there are 10 times that many questions about what to do in a particular situation. And so that's where you're going to have to pray and seek scripture and practice wisdom in order to know, in this situation, what should I be counseling this person to do? I think also that we can be proactive in partnering with some of these agencies. One of the things that we noticed in our ongoing effort with the rescue mission in town was, what's that word when people go back into prison? Yeah. How do you say it? I can't pronounce it. Anyway, you said it. Recidivism? See, it won't come out. I'd have to see it to say it. Anyway, we have the same thing at the mission, that they get in there, guys would even make professions of faith, and in that close Christian community there at the mission, they would be doing all right, showing responsibility. The mission required them to work. They'd do work. But as soon as they went out on their own, so often they were just going right back into the same relationships, and that led them into the same lifestyle as before. And so we thought, you know, as they're moving out of the mission, this is really where the church needs to be surrounding them and helping them. And so we created a partnership with the mission that we called Men with a Mission. And it had five components to it. And this is, again, this is just ideas, just ways that we as the church could be thinking to try to work and cooperate with legitimate Christian effort in our community. And if some of these men we were involved in ministry were coming to church, then we presented this program to them and asked them to consider being involved. And again, this never took off greatly. We had, you know, a handful of men going through it. We're no longer doing it just like this at Sycamore because of resources and other issues. But anyway, it had five components. One was that we would assign a guy at the mission, a personal mentor that usually was an elder or deacon in the congregation, who agreed over the course of the program to, and even beyond the 16 weeks that we asked them to be involved in this, that would be serve as their mentor, someone that they could meet with weekly to hold them accountable. So we assigned that. We asked them during that time to be involved in a class that would ground them in the scriptures, and I taught that class. I think I did survey courses to my memory of the Old and New Testament. Just I wanted them to be grounded in the Word of God and interacting. I made them share quiet times and keep a journal, and so just hearing their hearts as they were interacting with Scripture. We also provided during this time vocational training. There's a wonderful program called Jobs for Life. Jobs for Life, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it is a 16-week program, and it helps people think biblically about work and prepares them. A lot of people just don't know how to, you know, do things such as resumes, how to even work through employment applications. They don't know how to do interviews. And so it does all these kinds of things like that. But the other thing that it really encourages is for the church or whoever's sponsoring Jobs for Life in a community to learn how to network and find particularly Christian businessmen and businesses in the community that would hire people who've gone through the Jobs for Life program. And so that really was helpful to us as we identified some people in the community that were willing to work with these guys, and it was a way that we were able to provide some work for them. And you can find that on the web, Jobs for Life. Congregational living, we expected them to be in church, to attend at least one church activity throughout the week. We had Bible studies or fellowship activities, and so we wanted them to be integrated into the life of the church. That's how they're going to survive leaving the rescue mission. And then finally, we had a transitional planning. Their mentor would sit down as they were getting ready to leave the rescue mission and say, and put together a plan. Where are you going to live? How are you going to support yourself? What do you need from the church? And we put this plan together, come before the elders with it or the deacons with it, and kind of go through it. And so everybody was praying. It was like a team effort rather than just this guy solo going to go out there and try, try to live. Let me tell you the stories of two men that went through this. One was Phil and one was Mark. Both men had been arrested for robbing drugstores to get the meds they wanted, Oxycontin. I believe it was the case in both of them. Both of them had gotten arrested for the same type of crime. Both had gone to jail. Both had come to the mission. Both went through this program. Both of them lived, and one of our deacons bought a home that on the back of the garage had a room that he created, a bedroom with a shower and a little kitchen in and all that, so that he could house men there. This was only after he really had grown to trust these guys and really see what was going on in their lives. He also had started a leather working business and knife sheaths and things, and a lot of these guys would work doing that with him and for him. One of these guys, Phil, went back to old friendships and old ways, but he was still coming to church. He left Robert's place, went back to old friendships, old ways. The other guy, Mark, he had a problem with some things that took place, and he decided to leave Kokomo for a time, and he went to live with his mother who was dying. So there was some legitimacy to him going away, although it wasn't perfectly, we didn't think that was the best thing, but he decided to do that. Phil kept coming to church, but we were concerned because of his relationship. And I get a phone call, it was right around Christmas time, that he was dead from overdose. I'd remember that he'd just been in my office 3 days earlier in a church membership class where I'd asked him to write a testimony. And I hadn't looked at it. I just put it in my bag, and because it was holidays, I hadn't looked at it yet. I just went up and started reading this, thinking, what did he write? Pages of his struggles with drugs, but no mention of Christ. And it was just devastating, All the time, effort that we had put in to help this man. And I just really, I'm not the judge, but the indications are that he is not with the Lord. I was asked to preach at his funeral. So I preached from the parable that Jesus tells regarding the poor man and Lazarus. And I kind of started my message off with, I'm not here today to comfort you about where Phil is. But I can tell you what Phil would want you to know. Because the rich man wanted the living to know what he was going through. So I just approached it that way. One of our deacons gave a nice eulogy where he talked about how much he loved Phil and appreciated his friendship, but he didn't say this guy was in heaven, which is so typical in today's funerals. The other guy, Mark, who we thought maybe we had lost, 2 years after he left, he called us and he said, I want to come back to Kokomo. I miss you and I need the church. And my health has continued to deteriorate. I had horrible health problems created by his earlier drug use. And he came back and lived with Robert and ended up joining the church and giving a wonderful testimony of God's grace. And then pretty soon after that, one day he just died suddenly. Actually, Robert and I and some others were out at a meal down in Indianapolis, and he came home that night and found Mark dead in his room. You never know you know, in one sense, how God will work in individuals' lives, but we have to offer, you know, help and not send these people away. They're, God wants to bring them to us to care for and to, you know, be a family to. We were a family in one sense to both of these men, except one of them really ultimately rejected what we were wanting him so much to see. Let me give you a few further ideas as we wrap this up regarding this whole subject. As I've mentioned earlier, if we want to grow as a congregation in caring for the poor and the needy, I think it just really starts with prayer. That sounds canned, I understand, and the typical answer, but if you go back to our study last night from the Psalms, this should be, you know, more the regular cry of God's people. We are to be a people who are crying out to God in this world, this sin-cursed world where government powers are bringing ruin to so many millions of people's lives. We are to be the people who are crying out for justice. And how long, oh Lord, do these things, how long do we have to continue to live in a world like this? How long? And we need to be praying strong prayers, imprecatory prayers. You know, if we're going to pray, you know, we see the government doing things, let's maybe not get so angry because they've raised our taxes and that just affects us personally. But let's think about the poor who that hurts, or, you know, the ways that they are going about hurting the poor. That should really be what's driving our prayers for God to bring change. And then we need to be praying for the deacons in our congregation, just regularly praying for them and their work, asking them what we could be doing to support them. I think if mercy work is truly the fruit that the Lord desires, and, you know, times of harvest or times of celebration, like Thanksgiving, then when God does something, you know, when he just does something significant, you know, a guy gets a job, or a family's restored, or, you know, there was a need and somehow in the church it was met by the people of God. Again, you got to do this carefully so that, you know, you're not creating a memorial plaque or whatever. But we should be celebrating and highlighting works of mercy that God is doing in our midst. And giving opportunity for testimony. I'm not necessarily saying in the worship service we're not comfortable with that. But we ate a lot together as a church. We had a meal every Sabbath with one another. And one of the things we would do there is just highlight, you know, something that was going on in the life of God's people. It was just a place to give a little testimony. That's just encouraging. It just lifts people's spirits. There's certainly enough bad news in the world. Why not give opportunity to tell the good news of the things that the Lord is doing? In terms of the diaconate, I think sometimes we give assignments to entities in general without assigning specific responsibilities where accountability can be had. And I faced a presbytery commission for 16 months because of our mercy ministry. It nearly tore our congregation apart. Remember that warning last night? It wasn't because we weren't trying to help, but what ended up happening is a family that I thought was helping was actually turning hearts against me and what we were doing. There were people in the church that were sitting here trying to help a particular gal, and we were watching her kid, providing free childcare every day and running her back and forth to work and helping her manage her budget and find places to live and everything. And we were doing all this while she was being unfaithful and immoral. And when it came to trying to deal with some of those issues, you know, charges of being unloving and uncaring came up, and people started making lots of false accusations, which the commission eventually said. But through that, God taught me how important it is to keep good records, show the people who were truly responsible for certain things that were taking place. Even at times in interacting with someone of this nature, keeping a record of those interactions with them so that I was able to present what truly happened rather than, you know, their versions of it. So we need to, in other words, what I'm saying is this needs to be a well-run ship. Mercy ministry is not to be done sloppily. That's the way it can often be. And we want to do a good job unto the glory of God and how we handle it. And so that's why I'm saying we don't have to. Usually what a church needs to do is not go out and start something new. It just needs to get better at what it's already doing and figure out how can we be more faithful in what we're already doing as a congregation so that if we say we're going to do something, it gets done. If someone has done something, it gets reported. If monies have been used, everybody, you know, that's in charge knows where those monies and how those monies have been used. Just those kinds of things are very, very important in this, because the devil is in the details. The devil will, the details aren't there, the devil will come. And part of the reason I got into a little trouble was, I'm trying to be careful here. Let me put it this way. I was trying to protect somebody involved, and it caused me not to be as careful in conducting some of the business of session as I should have been. And that's where I got really attacked. And I confessed that wrong in my lack of administration on that part and learned from it. But you just have to be really careful is what I'm getting at. Because it was just incredible to see Satan, especially even after I thought I'd taken care of it, still see Satan trying to create doubt, suspicion, accusation against me primarily in this situation. So maybe I'm a little sensitive to that one. As I'm kind of pointing out here, I think we take our deacons, we slap our hands on them, and we leave them for 20 years. And, you know, there is just so many resources and training that can, you know, take place to keep helping our deacons and our whole congregation be trained in mercy. And so we should really see it that way. I mean, no pastor does his job well if he stops learning. You know, he goes to seminary and he's learned it all, and now he's just going to preach for the next 50 years without having to learn anymore. I mean, you're an ongoing student, guys, when you're, if you're thinking about pastoral ministry. So, sorry about that. It says signal out of range. Let me plug it in. I'm almost done here. See if it comes back on. Having ongoing training and coordination in mercy ministry, I think, is really important. And then finally, another way to involve the whole of the church in this more is, you know, we did elder visitations, not every year, but periodically, I would say. Sometimes we'd do it in consecutive years, but sometimes we'd let a year or two go by and then do it again. But we would be thematic in our elder visitations. So sometimes it would be looking at their walks with God. Sometimes it would be their relationship to the church. But one year we did one that I thought was very helpful to us, where we went and I learned this from John Tweed. Tell the congregation what you're going to be asking before you get there. So we produced 5 questions each time. These are the questions we're going to ask you, so they don't feel like we're going to come and just throw anything at them. Of course, other things can arise in the course of conversation, but this is what we're coming to ask you. We just care about you, and we want to know how it's going in these areas. But one year we put one together where we asked sort of an assessing type of question regarding what do you see as the gifts that God has given you in His service? Do you feel like they're being used? Do you feel like the congregation's doing a good job in the area of mercy ministry? Are there places where you see we're lacking? Are there needs that you're seeing that we're missing? That was very, very informative. You know, elders don't only need to teach, they need to listen. And elders, if there's four of them, they only got eight eyes, and the congregation has 100 or more, you know. So, and the church often sees things that the elders don't see, and it can actually help you in your shepherding work to hear from what the congregation is seeing and sensing. And so I found that one to be quite helpful. And it can create unity as people are being valued and seeing that they have a contribution that the elders and deacons want them to be making with respect to mercy. So let me just finish with this. This comes from the When Helping Hurts book by Fickert and Corbett. They talk in there about avoiding the God complex, or I might call it extreme takeover. You've heard of that show, Extreme Makeover? We had that actually happened in a house near us in Indiana. And it's kind of like the people who win the lottery. If you've ever followed stories about people who win the lottery, years later their life's a ruin. I've heard that a lot of these people who get their houses all made over, within years the place is returned to, you know, it's junked, or they've sold it and ruined their lives. I mean, we know that just cleaning the outside of the vessel just doesn't work. And so avoid what's called the God complex, or what we might call the extreme takeover, where, as they say, this is defined to be a subtle and unconscious sense of superiority in which they believe that they have achieved their wealth through their own efforts. These are the people trying to help the poor, and that they have been anointed to decide what is best for low-income people whom they view as inferior to themselves. And so in all of this, we got to just keep this in mind. You were slaves in Egypt, and you've been redeemed. You were slaves to sin, and God has redeemed you. By God's grace, you are who you are. And if it hadn't been for His grace, so goes you. I mean, you could be in the very same situation, apart from the grace of God. And so we have to avoid this God complex. And it's interesting, they use the word anointed. Just remember, we are not to be messiahs. You could also call this the Messiah complex. And I know people who just, there's a problem, they go rushing in. They're just attracted to problems like flies on honey. And they think they're going to solve the problem. But it's all really what it ends up being. It's about them. They want attention. They want to be the key figure. Remember what Jesus said in Luke 4:18. A Messiah is an anointed one. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because He anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. And when the church is preaching properly, when the church is functioning properly in the area of mercy, people who are touched by that are not touched by you ultimately. They are touched by Christ. They hear Christ through the faithful preaching of the word, and they see Christ through the faithful ministrations of His body. And that's what we want. We want people to see Christ, not us. So kind of my final thought there. Are there questions that you have? This may have raised. You've asked some of them during the course, which was fine. Any questions? Jonathan.
I don't know if you want to go back to those forms that you used.
I can.
But I wondered. Oh. I think our experience sometimes with a form, or just, I'm thinking about first contact, and your process might answer this. Like that questionnaire there, that actually is, I think we must have gotten ours from that. I'm trying to remember if we've talked about this on email or something at some point. Would that, in your experience, was that particular questionnaire typically filled out by the pastor, because the pastor is the one who's either at the church during the day or answering the church's phone? Or I was wondering whether your process actually has you holding off on that questionnaire until it's been referred to the deacons.
There were, you know, often, I had often two other people in the building with me. So we had a secretary and her husband, who was an associate pastor. So often they were around. So one of the three of us would take a call. And again, I don't mind spending 5 or 10 minutes asking a few questions and getting some basic information down, because I want to be able to talk to the deacons. If I tried to get them to call the deacons, that might not work so well because they're at work, that type of thing. So I thought, well, I'll just get the basic initial information, and then I could scan it and send the form to them. Or, again, because we were so close to the rescue mission, I could drop it off, or they would stop by and pick it up, or I would relate some of the information over the phone. Often they knew the person, so that would happen as well. So, usually we took the information down on the form so that we would have information to pass on to the deacon. But I could see a church, depending on deacon availability, saying he'll call you back. Sometimes they don't have numbers. They're borrowing a phone. And so it's not so easy to call them back, and you have to arrange for them to call you back at a certain time. So, and then they might not, because they found some other church to hit up. Well, it's just fine. I mean,
right. And maybe just tying in, I've thought about this a couple of times, and you mentioned something that made me think of it again, is just, can you maybe share a bit more about who your deacons were? Because I think you refer a lot to one, I forget the name, who was
Ron.
Employed
yeah.
at the rescue mission. Can you tell us a bit more about who your deacons were? And I guess what I'm partly wondering is, did the one whose full-time work was sort of in mercy-related work, was he doing a lot of it and you had other deacons who were less active? And what I'm getting at here is, I mean, we have four deacons, right? four active deacons locally. And none of us is employed right now in this sort of work. So I'm getting basically the issue of time, right? Mm-hmm. And available time. If you can share how that panned out amongst deacon boards that you see.
Yeah, their diaconal work for the church, beyond the fact that I could call them, a couple of them at work during their work hours and talk about some of these things, they didn't mind me doing that. But they didn't handle, sometimes they did. Yeah, sometimes they would say, well, just I'm free at 4, just send them down to the rescue mission, we'll handle it there. And they would kind of put on their deacon hat, and then depending on the need, they might switch it around to be the rescue mission guy. So that did happen. But primarily, we kept encouraging them, you know, because you're the deacons doesn't mean you have to do all of this. Are there other people in the church that can be trained to help you in some of this? So we got a lot of food requests, and we had a policy of we would spend up to, if somebody asked for food, we would spend up to $20 on groceries. We would take down a list. We would encourage, if the person could go with us to the store, to do that. They would often ask us if we could give them a voucher, but we're not going to put money in their hands because we don't know what they're going to do with it. But no, we'll take you to the store, but we were only going to get things that will be beneficial. You can't go there and ask for cigarettes or alcohol or, you know, those. We're not going to pay for, or junk food. We're not going to pay for that, but if there's, you know, healthy food that you and your family want, we can spend up to $20. And some of them would walk down the aisles with one of the women. You know, a woman would walk down the aisles with a woman at the church and, you know, pick out some food that she needed. And it just was a way to build relationship, a little rapport with them. But I also would tell them, you know, there are places that have meals. The rescue mission had meals. Our church always had a meal. If I got a request on a Saturday, I would invite them to come to church, eat with us, and then I'll arrange for you to meet with the deacons afterwards, which happened a couple of times. So they were sitting under the word for a time. One time we invited two families like that. And these folks there were two families living in the same house, and they were actually garbage pickers. I don't know this is an incredible phenomenon where if you put something out before garbage day, I've done this in my house and in Kokomo and here too. I mean, it's gone. I mean, people drive by and they scrap metal and they find things that they can resell and all this kind of stuff. And so they said they did that and just times were lean. It was, I think, a Saturday they called. So I invited them to church and they showed up and they had, I don't know how many kids. And they were kind of, this was when we were at the Y, they're running around. Well, the service is about to start, and I go to get my Bible, and I notice my sermon's not in there. My notes aren't in there. And I start looking around, and here's a page over here and a page there, and they've drawn on it. And I think I got it back together, but can't be too reliant on your notes. But I think anything we can do to get them around the church is part of the solution.